In one of the sutras of Patanjali, one of the methods by which we may be able to control or become vigilantly aware of the mental modifications or ideas is considered the dual process of abhyasa and vairagya, practice, as also the cultivation of dispassion. What is practice? Tatra sthito yatno abhyasa. Whatever enables us to be steadily rooted in the inquiry, to be steadily rooted in the vigilance, and unless, again, this is borne in mind, I may start doing something which, instead of helping me onward, might lead me astray. To give you an example that suddenly came to my mind, I am a great devotee of God, and I want to build a temple for God. Somewhere in some scriptures it is said that you, if you build a temple for God, you go to heaven straight away. That sort of thing. You know, this kind of thing is found everywhere. In both Jewish and Buddhist religions, or I think it's even in Islam. Merely to copy the scripture is considered a very holy practice, very meritorious. If you copy the Bible 10 times, if you copy the Buddha sutras 10 times, some doors open which were not open before, right? Like this, in some Hindu scriptures, there is even the suggestion that if you build a temple, you'll go straight to heaven. I think in Roman Catholicism, in the early years, they built many of their cathedrals on this principle. If I'm not mistaken, even the Westminster Abbey was built by some king as a sort of atonement for something, to gain a dispensation from the Pope. What we don't realize is that these things are not built by kings and popes, but by poor laborers who are employed as slaves. Anyhow, that's another story. So now, that's not another story, that is the story. So now I want to build a temple as a house of God, because I am a great devotee of God. Let's even say I have the money for it. That's not a problem. Then what do I do? During the course of building that temple, I am so terribly involved in drawing up the plans and meeting the architects and fighting with the contractors and cheating the laborers. A million of these sins are accumulated all along the way that halfway through I have completely forgotten all my devotion to God. Though, certainly the scripture says that if you are devoted to God, build a temple for Him. In all these cases, one has to be very cautious in understanding the injunction, the commandment, or the scriptural statement. You know, when the Wright brothers announced that they could fly, some priests denounced the whole thing. No, the scripture says only, the scripture says angels fly. But the scripture did not say that human beings cannot fly. The scripture did say angels fly. But I can also fly. I may also fly. Who knows? When the scripture commanded thou shalt build a temple for thy Lord, they did not command, in the meantime, you should forget all about him. That is what we do. If you are a devotee of God, why do you forget God in the meantime? You are building a temple for God, but by the time you have built the temple, there is no God. That sort of thing might happen. Very often it happens. Very often. And therefore, all through what we call abhyasa or practice of yoga, whatever be the practice undertaken, doesn't matter what. And as long as it has some relevance to your life. This is another tragedy in our practice of yoga. Our yoga has no relevance to our life at all. It seems to be completely disconnected, disjointed. Whereas yoga means joining. All that you hear about yoga is something which takes you away from life. You must be something funny, you must be a strange person. Your behavior must be strange. Your attitude to life must be strange. Everything is strange and funny. You know, a yogi is not supposed to value good appearance. You know, he is completely unconcerned with his appearance. Unconcerned with your appearance, why not be neat and clean and be unconcerned? Is that right? I think that's terribly more sensible. Be neat and clean, wash your clothes and wash your skin. And if not for your sake, for the sake of others. And be unconcerned. And be unconcerned. And then the yogi is not supposed to... some teachers have even said that yogi loathes the very sight of money and women. Kamini Kanchana. What these devils. Devil's own instruments. So, and I have seen this. I don't know if you have seen very good people. They are supposed to be devotees of God, and they are supposed to be full of desire for liberation, moksha, and so on. They are living an ordinary life. They are not monks or monkeys or whatever it is. They are leading an ordinary life. And they may even come to a Swami with some offering. This is how I come to know this, this funny behavior. They even come to the Swami with some fruits or some cakes, and there is always some money in it. And that currency note I have always seen is crumpled. You know, they have, I don't touch my, I hate it. So you. Must I show my indifference to wealth by crumpling a currency note? It's a funny behavior. I don't know if you have seen this kind of thing. That is, I don't care for money. And so, don't care, please don't care, don't bestow any attention upon it. Don't run after money by all means. But if you have $10 bills, keep them nicely, neatly. There's no harm in it, is there? There's no harm in it. If we don't understand the spirit of yoga, then we can become extremely strange creatures, unusual creatures. You will attract attention. You'll attract attention. You know, you must have heard this umpteen times. If you haven't, at least hear from us, you're attractive. Now, having said that, so lest your head may swell, you know, people may call her attractive. People may call somebody else also attractive. Yeah? Someone who is physically beautiful may be also considered attractive. Someone who is terribly unbeautiful may also be attractive. I'm sure if you found someone with a nose hanging with a large ear and then the most ugly creature on earth, everybody will look. That is what I call attractive. To be attractive, does to be attractive only means you attract people's attention. Is that right? To be attractive. So you don't have to be, whether you are good or whether you are bad, you attract attention. Whether you behave, somehow you have to be unusual. Somehow you have to be unusual. Why must I be unusual? Why not be part of the life stream, exactly like everybody else? Why behave in an unusual way? Just to attract? To become attractive is not all that important in life. That is important to remember. It is the spirit of yoga that matters, not to become something unusual. I cannot become a yogi if I am something unusual. If I am something unusual, either people would put me on a pedestal to worship me, in which case I am not there with them, or they would trample upon me. Again, I am not with them. Either they lionize you. If you go to India, you will see this everywhere. Some swamis, you will find them riding on elephants and so on, drum beating, everybody throwing flowers at him. And some others are trampled upon. And there are some people who are called devotees and so on, religious people, who worship any ochre-robed person. And there are other people who are, you may call them communists, you may call them anything you like, atheists, communists. They would be ready to spit upon any sort of holy robe. That's all. But why not be? Why not be in this stream? That's the yogi. To be in this stream and to live such a life as would be in strict accordance with the spirit of yoga. That is when we don't lose the spirit of yoga. Whatever I do, whatever practice I do, it must have a direct relevance to life itself. And when that life is lived in accordance with the spirit of yoga, you become a yogi, never mind your appearance. So these are the two things to be borne in mind. Whatever be the practice we indulge in, the spirit of yoga is not forgotten at any stage, and that practice has direct relevance, immediate relevance to my life. Otherwise it is not yoga. However, the word abhyasa has also been taken to mean the eightfold practice that is set out at great length in the Yoga Sutras themselves. We'll have a quick look at the first five, and tomorrow we'll deal with the last three. Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara. These are the five preliminaries And these are considered Bahiranga. These are considered externally visible, externally recognizable practices of yoga. The other three that we shall discuss tomorrow are internal, inward. I think that distinction is terribly important to remember. Lest I should forget tomorrow, I'll tell you that now. What we are going to discuss tomorrow are the last three, that is Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi. Dharana is concentration, Dhyana is meditation, Samadhi is super consciousness or self-realization, enlightenment. And these are supposed to be antaranga, inward, inward. These are not things which are meant to be paraded in public. Antarangam. If they are inward, then these inward practices of yoga are constant throughout my daily life. If you remember that tomorrow, then you will realize that yoga is not, the meditation is not sitting in a corner with closed eyes. Then that is obvious. It's an external practice. It's a practice that is obvious to its publicity, stunt. Whereas, if meditation is to be antaranga, inward, then it must be something which nobody notices. You may be painting, you may be sculpturing, you may be singing, dancing, or reading, talking, cooking, sweeping. And in and through all this, the spirit of meditation is preserved, antarangam. That's why it is called inner practice, inward practice. Not a gimmick which you do in order to attract attention, again, attract attention. The first five are very interesting, and in the sutras, all the eight are called angas. Anga means a limb. Limb of the body. It is usual for teachers of yoga to refer to these as steps, the eight steps of yoga. The word step is not there in the original text. The text only says Anga, Ashtanga Yoga. If you look at a baby boy, that baby boy on the first day of his life on earth is a complete baby boy, is a complete miniature man. All his limbs, all the organs of the body are present at the moment of birth. It is not as though that some kind of a God decides, you know, after all, what does the baby require during the first two or three months? What does the baby do? Only a mouth and a stomach, intestinal. It's not thinking, it is not making use of its brain for the present. So, give birth to your baby, just a mouth and a stomach. And then afterwards you can slowly, you know, add on. After some time, the brain starts growing. And after some time, arms start coming out. It doesn't happen that way. On the very first day, the whole baby is born, together. All intact, all the organs intact. Even so, on the very first day you begin to practice yoga, all these eight limbs must be born together. So don't say that I am practicing asana now, in another 10 years' time I'll practice pranayama. By the time you are dead, And then comes, you know, pratyahara, and then comes dharana, and then comes dhyana, and then I will go to the Himalayas for samadhi. That kind of thing doesn't happen. The whole baby must be delivered. All limbs intact on the very first day. So if I practice yoga, I must practice all the eight limbs, all the eight aspects of this yoga, right from the first day. And you will see, as we go on, that it cannot be otherwise. The first limb is called Yama. Yama is another Sanskrit word which has got about two pages of meaning. One is the god who presides over death. That's also called Yama. Yama is also also means restraint. Yama also means someone who says, thus far, no further. That's what death does. Eh? I go on doing all sorts of funny things, and something comes down and says, thus far, no further. That'll do. Enough, enough for this lifetime. And so on. So many other meanings it has got. The god who presides over righteousness and the virtue and so on. Here the Yama is again fivefold. Ahimsa, Satyam, Asteyam, Brahmacharya, Aparigraha. The five. What are they? Ahimsa, non-injury. Non-violence in thought, word and deed. There have been people who have said that, oh, this must be practiced before you can proceed any further, before you can even practice asanas, before you can think of doing some pranayama. And their argument being that unless you are well established in all these virtuous qualities, self-control and so on, your mind will not allow you to meditate, and your prana will be disturbed. And so you cannot do pranayama, you cannot do meditation, perhaps. Or it may also work the other way around, that unless you learn how to meditate, you may not know in how many hundreds and thousands of little ways this violence manifests in you. Even as you are watching your mind to see where violence is, what violence, what kind of violence, what exactly do I mean by violence? Am I really, really non-violent? I don't know. If I remember it correctly, it seems once Socrates was sitting outside his house, and a soldier was chasing a murderer or something. And the soldier knew Socrates, and said, "Hey, old man, did you see a murderer run past this way?" And Socrates looked, "Murderer? What do you mean, murderer? A killer? Oh, butcher? No. A man who kills a man. Oh, a soldier. A man who kills a man in peacetime. Oh, executioner. A man who kills a man in peacetime in his own house. Oh, a doctor." It's funny, but then we do not regard all these things as killing, as murder. I saw a modern, the latest translation of the Holy Bible, where the Ten Commandments are translated in very modern language, it's not thou shalt not kill anymore, thou shalt not commit murder. And afterwards it's up to you and me, we assemble together in a sort of council to decide what exactly the good Lord meant by murder. This is not murder, that is not murder. Killing someone in self-defense is not murder. And what does self-defense mean? You know, if you become a lawyer, you learn all this. Even before you learn what law means. How to interpret, how to twist and turn to suit oneself. So, these virtues, the yama, cannot be practiced unless you are all the time conscious within yourself. Unless there is this torch of vigilance burns rightly in you. Otherwise, it is not possible. I have heard it said, oh, I believe in some countries still, in Muslim countries and so on, polygamy is allowed. I guess so. And what about you? Of course, we are strictly monogamous. Uh-huh. Is that so? Well, if I don't like this woman, I divorce her and get married to another. That's precisely what I call polygamy. No man sleeps with three women at the same time. So, what's the great difference? The thing is still the same. I have merely twisted it to suit my convenience. And this, if it is a spiritual truth, a spiritual law, cheating oneself or bluffing oneself is a waste of time. And when will I really and truly adopt these principles? Only when I am vigilant. Vigilantly watchful to see where I am bluffing myself. That's the Bible also. Most of the time when Jesus quarreled with one or the other of those fellows, he invariably used the title, you hypocrite. That's the worst of all sins, for want of a better word. How can this hypocrisy go? Only when I am vigilantly watching myself. And that vigilance itself is yoga. Yoga is not something which comes later. Yoga comes right there. The first step, if you want to call it a step. Right there, the whole yoga is there. If I want to practice non-violence, the whole of yoga is there. I don't pretend that I am allowed righteous indignation. We were witness to a beautiful drama in India. There was an enormous conference and we landed in a prompt minute, almost on the first week of my visit to India, 1968-69. And the whole stage was ablaze with color, all these robes, and some of them had even colored their beard, white beard with ochre, flaming. And I think the first day or the second day, something went wrong. The first speaker, every speaker had been allotted 45 minutes or so, and the first speaker happened to come late, about 25 minutes late. So just after about 10 minutes, some organizer passed a note under his beard. 5 minutes more. And the man blew. Phew, yeah. Everything caught fire there. And then somebody made the dreadful mistake of picking up an argument. He said, you came late. And this man blew up. Your car came late. I didn't come late. I was waiting in my room from 7 o'clock this morning. Your car came late. Your transport came late. I'm not at fault. And the organizer happened to be near me. I told him, don't do anything. Go there, fall at his feet, tell him, holy man, forgive me, and speak as long as you like. It's my fault. He did so, immediately he calmed down.
Ah, good.
And he went on. That was a miracle. If I had lost my temper and shouted like that, I would have forgotten what I was saying before. But he didn't. After all these histrionics, he came back just where he left off. And he continued as nothing happened. That was marvelous. And then that evening, we had a dinner at the Rotary Club. And somehow this topic dropped. We were all in a very jovial mood. And someone remarked, what kind of holiness is this, that even holy people become angry? He was there. Suddenly he flew into rage. Of course, only we can be angry. The others, they can't be angry. We are here to correct them. Only we can be become angry. These people cannot become angry. That's it. We can tell ourselves all sorts of marvelous things. I don't become violent at all. But then there is a school teacher here. She says, Swami, if I'm to be completely non-violent, the children in the class won't obey me. Mustn't I punish?
Yes.
She has some small children. She says, of course, if my son persists in going and touching the oven, is it not right for me to spank him? Of course. So we bring in all sorts of funny arguments to prove to ourselves that these are all allowed. Righteous indignation is allowed. Losing one's temper or anger, getting angry in order to correct others in one's custody, allowed. So you go on, like the French language, you formulate a rule and then go on with the exceptions. There are so many of them, you have forgotten the rule before you're halfway through. And therefore, without the rule and without the exception, I can only arrive at the correct understanding of it if I vigilantly watch what happens within me. Only then it is possible to understand what is meant by yama. Otherwise, our whole life will be one of either perversion or fanaticism. Both these are extremes. Either you are fanatically saying, oh no, I won't become angry at all. And he may go on murdering or shaving her head off. Om Tat Sat, Om Shanti, Om Tat Sat, Om Shanti. Or I become perverted and lose my temper at the least provocation and blame the whole thing on the provocation. And this applies to all the various disciplines mentioned under this head. Then the next limb is called niyama. Niyama is a well-regulated life. Niyama only means this in simple language, well-regulated life. Shaucha, santosha, tapaswadhyaya, ishara pranidhana. Shaucha, purity, cleanliness. Santosha, contentment. Tapaswadhyaya, ishara pranidhana. An austere, simple life. Swadhyaya, study, recollection. And ishara pranidhana, devotion to God. All these things regulate our life. And once again, all these things remind us constantly of the yogic spirit. The third is called the asana. Asana can mean sthira sukham asanam. Any firm and comfortable sitting posture is asana. Unfortunately, the word sitting is not there. Any firm and comfortable is posture. Sthira sukham asanam. I must try to translate it literally. Sthira, firm, sukham, pleasant, asanam, posture. It's not, even the word sitting is not there. Why was the word sthiram or firmness used? Because of a theory that if the body is restless, the mind might also be restless. Will also be restless. But then, if this yoga is meant to be a whole life affair, then it has got, the mind has got to be steady even when the body is not steady. I've got to be active, I've got to work. And even when I am working, the body appears to be restless, the mind must be restful, peaceful. So that when it comes to the posture again, it may mean something very different. Something very different. What is what you are taught in the Hatha Yoga classes is perhaps not what is meant by the posture here, or it may even mean that. It may not mean, or it may mean. If it does not mean, there is no problem. But if it does mean, if it does include all those postures, what is the meaning? That's marvelous, something beautiful. You are accustomed to a certain standing posture. You stand with your head up and feet down. You stand with both your feet planted firmly on the floor. And then suddenly some yoga teacher comes along and says, stand on your head. It's an unusual thing, funny thing. While you assume the posture, the whole balance is lost. The function of the body is reversed. And things seem to happen in your head, and things seem to happen in your stomach, and things seem to happen in your feet. And you watch. If you are, if you have learned to watch yourself, this is most wonderful. For the first few minutes, you know what happens. There's all sorts of things running around in the head. And something seems to have burst around the neck. And whatever the heart contains, blood or whatever, water or whatever it is, it's pouring down the neck into the head, really bursting. Your face is becoming hot. Your eyes want to come out. All sorts of things happen within the first few seconds. And the yoga teacher is there and says, oh, don't come down. Don't come down, don't come down. And then for the next minute or so, you are enjoying it. Suddenly the whole, the body, the intelligence in the body probably got a shock. Never expected that you would be so crazy as to stand on your head. And then suddenly it says, aha, this is what you are doing now. Good. And then the whole intelligence goes to work and you find the head relaxing, the eyes relaxing, the neck relaxing, the breathing becoming more and more steady. Marvelous. I did something crazy, and yet this intelligence was so intelligent that it was really able to restore balance. Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that beautiful? I did something terribly unusual, crazy. But this intelligence in the body was so clever that within hardly half a minute, it was able to restore harmony. Thus I discover that even if mistakes are made in our life, even if we make dreadful mistakes in our life, that intelligence is somehow able to restore harmony. Then I get strength, faith. This is called faith. Once I have discovered this inner intelligence and discovered its omnipotence, then I get really faith, conviction in what you call God, in what you call God's grace and so on. So it may be, even these postures are included. And then comes pranayama. Pranayama, I think we have discussed pranayama enough. Not to need any more further discussion. Pranayama to me only means this, not just regulation of breath, though regulated breathing does calm down the mind, steady the mind. And Patanjali himself gives us the following as the benefit of pranayama. Katakshiyate prakashavaranam dharanasu yogita manasah. By the persistent practice of this pranayama, the veil that veils the truth, the intelligence in you is removed, and the mind becomes fit for concentration. What is the veil? What is the veil of ignorance? The veil of ignorance suggests that I am this body. The veil of ignorance suggests that there is no great supernormal intelligence in me. My mind, my brain is the only intelligent instrument I have. This must go. How will it go? By the practice of pranayama. And what is the practice of pranayama here? The pranayama is when prana and apana become equal. Pranapano samau krutva nasa bhyantar charino, says Krishna in the Gita. Prana and apana must become equal. What is prana? Prana is that which promotes life. What is apana? Apana is that which brings on death. Prana promotes life, apana promotes death. Can these two become equal? Can I be as unafraid to live as to die? Can I face life and can I face death without longing for one and hating the other? Do life and death mean exactly the same to me? Then I am practicing pranayama. Am I anxious to live or am I anxious to die? Then I am not practicing pranayama. When these two become completely equal, so that you can look within and honestly say, if this happens, okay, that happens also, okay. Then you are really and truly practicing pranayama. And in all this, not only in the next stage called pratyahara, in all this, your vision is resolutely turned within. From there on, we'll continue tomorrow.
ಸ್ವಪಂ ಯಜಾಮಹೇ ಸುಗಂಧಿಂ ಪುಷ್ಟಿವರ್ಧನಂ ಉರ್ವಾರುಕಮಿವ ವಂದನಾಂ ದದ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷೀಯಮಾಮೃತಾತ್. ಓಂ ತ್ರಯಂಬಕಂ ಯಜಾಮಹೇ ಸುಗಂಧಿಂ ಪುಷ್ಟಿವರ್ಧನಂ ವಂದನಾಂ ದದ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷೀಯಮಾಮೃತಾತ್. ಓಂ ತ್ರಯಂಬಕಂ ಉರ್ವಾರುಕಮಿವ ವಂದನಾಂ ದದ್ಯೋರ್ಮುಕ್ಷೀಯಮಾಮೃತಾತ್. ಸರ್ವೇಷಾಂ ಸ್ವಸ್ತಿ ಭವತು, ಸರ್ವೇಷಾಂ ಶಾಂತಿರ್ಭವತು, ಸರ್ವೇಷಾಂ ಪೂರ್ಣಂ ಭವತು, ಸರ್ವೇಷಾಂ ಮಂಗಳಂ ಭವತು. ಸರ್ವೇ ಭವಂತು ಸುಖಿನಃ, ಸರ್ವೇ ಸಂತು ನಿರಾಮಯಾ, ಸರ್ವೇ ಭದ್ರಾಣಿ ಪಶ್ಯಂತು, ಮಾ ಕಶ್ಚಿತ್ ದುಃಖ ಭಾಗ್ ಭವೇತ್. ಅಸತೋ ಮಾ ಸದ್ಗಮಯ, ತಮಸೋ ಮಾ ಜ್ಯೋತಿರ್ಗಮಯ, ಮೃತ್ಯೋರ್ಮಾ ಅಮೃತಂ ಗಮಯ. ಓಂ ಪೂರ್ಣಮದಃ ಪೂರ್ಣಮಿದಂ ಪೂರ್ಣಾತ್ ಪೂರ್ಣಮುದಚ್ಯತೇ ಪೂರ್ಣಸ್ಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮಾದಾಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮೇವಾವಶಿಷ್ಯತೇ. ಓಂ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ.